right now I'm teaching a class, Methods of Inquiry, that's very much about how ought we to go about knowing and what should we believe? What are the ethics of belief? And in that class, we've been having this sort of ongoing debate about different kinds of bias in our methodological structures and in the life of our belief systems. And there's all kinds of ones that you read about. I mean, confirmation bias being an obvious one, proportionality bias, for instance, which is the assumption that something that has high consequence must also have a big source of determination. And I think also back to a conversation Nate and I had a couple of weeks ago about a recent On the Media episode in which a Dartmouth College English professor, and he was arguing that the kind of spreading popularity of various forms of conspiracy belief are actually a species of Gnosticism, you know, going back to the ancient heresy, which to me, Gnosticism at its root is sort of this idea that there's the facade and what appears to be the case, and then there's the hidden reality and the truth, which actually kind of ties back to almost Plato's analogy of the cave, right? That there's what seems to be the semblance of truth, but then there's the real, real truth. And getting to the real, real truth, you know, that deeper, more foundational root stem of what is ontologically true is what a lot of conspiracy theories appeal to, this kind of sense that you're in the know, whereas other people are not. And, you know, that editorial you pointed to, Robert, kind of speaks to that. For people who are awash in anxiety and alienation, who feel that everything is kind of spinning out of control in their lives, conspiracy theories offer really effective emotional tools for coping with that and for providing a sense of stability and at least explanation for what's going on, that they're a part of some broader structural system that's mysterious, you know? So there's something to that idea. And I think some of this relates to COVID, right, Nate?
No, that I think that all makes sense, Alex. So the editorial that you're talking about by David Brooks in the New York Times, who does, I think, identify as a conservative, the provocative title is The Rotting of the Republican Mind. And it's about some of the things that you're bringing up. And there's a paragraph in there kind of about conspiracy theory thinking. And I think it's worth just quoting it. It says, "For those in low status groups, conspiracy theories provide a sense of superiority, as in, I possess important information most people do not have. Secondly, for those who feel powerless, conspiracy theories provide agency. I have the power to reject quote unquote experts and expose hidden cabals. And finally, conspiracy theories can provide a kind of liberation. So if I imagine my foes are completely malevolent, then I can use any tactic I want." And I think that that's probably the cogent heart of the essay. There's other parts that I would sort of quibble strongly with. He seems to blame it on condescension. I mean, he doesn't provide any evidence for this. And here's another misconception, I think, that is at the center of this piece. But it seems to be based on this assumption that working class people or poor people or uneducated people vote for Donald Trump. And from all the evidence that I can see, that's just not verifiably true. I think it's actually kind of the opposite. I'm looking at exit data from this year's election, and 2019, for people who made the household total family income under $50,000, those people voted for Joe Biden 55-44. People in the $50,000 to $100,000 total income voted for Biden 57-42. And it's only once you get up into like $100,000 or more in total family income that you get an advantage for Trump of 54-42. If we're talking about class specifically on its own, there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that either the uneducated or the people that don't make very much money vote overwhelmingly for Republicans. That's just not true. But I guess I just would like to see more evidence about like why these people who are claiming they feel disenfranchised are actually feeling disenfranchised, and if they have real reason to feel that way. There's a part of me that wonders if we're talking about just a bunch of sophisticated excuses. I mean, people find reasons to believe what they want to believe. I understand the point that people can feel extreme levels of suffering and strife, and that can push them to think things that are illogical or without evidence. But I'm not sure. Again, I go back to the fact that by a 10 to 15 point margin, people who are in rough shape are actually voting for the Democrat. And again, it's probably important to parse that data. But this larger point that there are plenty of people who are struggling who are not ascribing to these kind of insane conspiracy theories. And so what makes up for the difference? My hypothesis would be that there are some of those folks that really, really just want to believe something and will create evidence for it, even though it doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I think there. I think to your point, there's a lot of good evidence and research that looks at the extent to which almost everyone feels disenfranchised. I mean, almost everyone feels like they occupy an unfair or unbalanced system of oppression in which they are not subject to the kind of karmic response that they feel that they have earned. Part of this has to do with what Michael Sandel has recently called the tyranny of merit, meritocratic value systems that underlie our culture in myriad ways that are complicated and historical. But in part, I think it has led to this strange effect where there's this near universal disempowerment feeling where many people feel victimized. Even, you know, the president of the United States, as powerful as he is, the most powerful person in the world, one could argue, feels disempowered, feels like he lacks agency, feels like he is subject to a system, right? A system, this is the Gnostic part, a system that is sort of shadowy and escapes the empirical observation, but nonetheless upholds and sustains an unfair and unjust set of structure. To me, this relates to some other areas of interesting social psychology research. And again, I would point to Hinbrain and some of the episodes they've done around this, that actually within a system or within a structure that is perceived by its members as being unfair, there's a high level of cheating behavior can be expected within that system. And so this is to sort of to your point that people can very easily rationalize cheating against the rules or norms of a given system if they feel like they're not fairly treated by it. And so you might say, right, that in that sense, a feeling of disenfranchisement, whether it's fair or not, that within a culture that kind of espouses that kind of widespread disenfranchisement, you would expect conspiracy theories to be popular. This is interesting because there's also research in political science that shows that usually conspiracy theories come from a party that has lost power recently. So it's the minority party that traditionally has fomented interest in conspiracies, again, as a kind of explanatory framework.
Germany post-World War I.
Yeah, exactly. But more recently, what we've seen, like in the last 4 years, is it's the party in power that has been more accused, at any rate, of being engaged in conspiratorial thinking. And we should be precise with these terms and what we're talking about, but belief without evidence. But you know, the Brooks essay, whatever else we might think about it, Brooks writes, rebuilding trust is obviously the work of a generation. Is that how you see the current challenge? Do you accept his narrative there around trust being what's needed at this point?
Well, Brooks is writing in the New York Times. I think that a lot of the people that he's talking about trying to reach out to stop listening at the very mention of the New York Times or any sort of major mainstream publication. So I don't know. I guess I would be interested in hearing from him about more detailed like prescriptions or what he thinks might be necessary, what steps might be necessary in order to rebuild that trust. As I mentioned before, I'm not convinced that there's some sort of structural hierarchy that's meant to condescend to another class or another stratus of our society. And I would also point out, David Brooks himself is part of the structures and cultures that he's bemoaning. I remember this column from a few years ago, I think from 2017 of his, when he talks about being the op-ed editor at the Wall Street Journal. And he talks about the Whitewater scandal from like the Clinton era. And he says, this is a quote from that piece. He says, "We ran a series of investigative pieces, quote, raising serious questions, as we say in the scandal business, about the nefarious things the Clintons were thought to have done back in Arkansas. I confess I couldn't follow all the actual allegations made in those essays." Okay, so he's like owning up to the fact that he himself has pitched conspiracy theory thinking and that he himself couldn't follow that stuff and wasn't particularly interested in knowing the details about the conspiracy theories that he was pitching. So I guess I'd make the point that they're not really new and they can come and go. And I think that they're tools that are used by Alex Jones and Tucker Carlson. And I don't think that Alex Jones and Tucker Carlson, whoever else you want to point out, Rush Limbaugh, those are not people who are feeling disenfranchised. Those are not people who are feeling powerless. Those are not conspiracy theories that are coming out of struggle. I feel like they're tools that are used to develop passion and chaotic thinking, which can be used to benefit not just their political power, but also their pocketbooks.
Nate Bauer directs the University of Alaska Press, and Alexander Hirsch teaches political science at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm Robert Hannon.